I'm Evan Applegate. I'm a cartographer, and on Very Expensive Maps, I talk to better cartographers. This week's guest is Jeff Clark, a self-described accidental cartographer who spent a year and a half creating a minutely detailed 3x5-foot map of the Pacific Northwest.
My name is Jeff Clark. I'm based in North Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, and I run a small map design firm called Clark Geomatics. I started off in geophysics, went over to GIS after some bad market crashes in the mining business, and got fed up with that stuff and moved over to GIS, Geographic Information Systems. So I make my living doing that. This is a side gig for me mostly. Therefore, this is the reason I literally call myself an accidental cartographer. This is developed off the side of my desk. So that was trying to improve maps for clients, and got interested in the mountain cartography aspect of it after seeing a few maps. And we've got a beautiful park right near Vancouver called Garibaldi Provincial Park. It's a high mountain park, really picturesque, kind of a crown jewel of our park system here. And I said, well, I'm going to practice some of the techniques I've seen on the web. Back in probably, 2007, around there. And ended up creating a map, took a chance, called the Mountain Equipment Co-op, which is very similar to the REI down in Washington. So it's a mountain gear co-op. And they took it on. And so I've been doing that ever since on the side.
The accidental cartographer.
I just picked this stuff up as I went along, just out of interest. So kind of like the accidental tourist who finds himself in different places without really knowing how he got there.
You said you started in trying to improve the maps that your clients would get, which I assume was kind of easy since all those maps were kind of hideous.
Oh, you've heard about GIS maps, have you? Yes. Yeah, well, that is the case. So trying to put a bit of, our own branding on it in the consulting firm I'm in. So, it just evolved from there, improving that. And then just expanding our products a bit and saying, okay, you guys need an atlas of this. And so we can turn all this GIS data into maps and helping utilities with infrastructure mapping. That's basically where it came from.
What a differentiator too, a consulting firm that can have absolutely stunningly beautiful maps in addition to all the, the reams of PDFs that they buy.
They did like that. It was a nice touch. Not always feasible, not always part of a budget, because not everybody appreciates a good map, as you know. So sometimes it was a bit of a push to get them to accept that. But otherwise, very, very happy clients with that. With the improved mapping that they would get, and from my point of view, it's like I enjoyed that aspect of the contract anyway. So let's go.
And did you teach yourself GIS and cartography?
Not GIS. No, I did a advanced technical degree out of British Columbia Institute of Technology. So this is after I had an undergrad in geophysics, which I went to McGill in Montreal, got that, came out, bumped around in the mineral exploration business, and then went back to just a one-year intensive program in GIS. The cartography aspect was kind of a bit of not a really big leap to start learning about cartography, but the black box part is when you start talking the Illustrator and the Adobe products and getting into that and trying to, that's a massive learning curve. I was spending, my mapping hours were essentially 11 o'clock at night till 2 in the morning trying to figure out this stuff. So that's what I was doing. Just trying to figure out 10% of that software so I could make a better map.
That learning curve of fighting with Illustrator to make it look nice, there's no way out but through. There's no training program for that. You just got to show up and put in your reps.
Yep. Poke this, try that. Try to remember what that sequence was, and a big fat book open beside you back in 2007. Yeah, just learning. And then, of course, there's other cartographers out there. Tom Patterson always had a fantastic website telling people how to do stuff, and Daniel Huffman also the same thing. He got me into the Blender thing, just like everybody else did on the web, and then he revolted against the Blenderization of maps, which was, I agree.
Daniel taught me how to make maps. I sat at his elbow for about 18 months at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. They have an MS cartography program there, of which maybe 1% is cartography and the rest is obtuse PDFs about cartography. And so if I wanted to learn how to make maps, you got to do it and Daniel was generous enough to teach me how to do it at close range.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I always say we got to train cartographers like jewelry engravers or glass gilders. You're at a table, you got an apron, you got a master at your elbow telling you what to do. Because otherwise, you got to be a 10-star autodidact, as you learned. You got to just be you and the book and trial.
Yep. And that timeline is very long compared to having a master by your side. I mean, okay, we can have YouTube by our side, but still, it's not the same thing. It's not the same thing. You don't get nuances. You don't get very small distinctions that are made and why the reasoning. And you don't get to ask questions to YouTube either. So.
Yeah, exactly. When you're stuck, essentially, until you reach out in an asynchronous way or sleep on it for 2 weeks. You started making these geophysical consulting maps cuter, and then this Garibaldi Park could have a much nicer map. I'm going to tackle that.
That started in 2008, I think. It took me almost, took me a good 8-9 months to get that map up to snuff. You know, I had seen a 1974 version of the park map, and then, you know, I went online to see if it was available for the park, and it's, oh my God, there's this horrible black and white flat cartoon drawings of this beautiful park. And I went, okay, well, let's try that. Let's see what happens. And so I based my type of work, it's kind of like a Swiss style map, quite a detailed 50,000 scale map done in 1974, and it was a beautiful map. So I was trying to replicate that. That's what I tried to do. And after, you know, probably close to a year, 3/4 of a year, something popped out at the other end. So yeah, I walked down to Mountain Equipment Co-op and said, hey, here's a map. You guys interested in retailing this? And they said, oh, wow. Yeah, sure. The funny part is they took the map, which I had printed on a synthetic paper, which is essentially, layers of plastic that is almost indestructible. I had this done, printed, dropped off a few maps for the MEC folks to take up the mountain in the wintertime, you know, to cross a neve that's quite famous for that in that park. So they take this map with them. And then I hear back after the weekend, and what had happened while they were up there is this map, while they were pointing at the map with their gloves or with their ski poles, basically all the ink came off. So the map was essentially, you know, it was producing a whiteout, you know, while they were in a whiteout trying to figure out where they were going. So they said, this map's not quite working for us. So I literally had to send the maps back to the printer and said, you know, according to retail law in Canada, if you don't produce a map that's as advertised, it's, you know, you can't do that. So I sent it back. I sent the maps back and returned them. And they said, what about that invoice? I said, sorry. So I moved on to a different printer after that. But it was quite surprising that my map was literally disintegrating in the hands of my client. So lesson learned.
Oh, man. I'm surprised those mountain climbers didn't ambush you outside your car.
Well, that's what I was thinking, you know, and then they were kind enough to say, I told them, look, I changed printers and let's try this again. They said, yeah, sure. Okay, let's do it. It was all good sailing from there, but really, really surprising. Printing is the black box of, you know, of that whole mapping business. Printing is, you really have to pay attention to what's going on there. So all I had to do is make the text on my map, do not use for navigation, a little bigger.
The real cartographers get out of jail free for entertainment purposes only.
Yeah, this map is not intended for navigation. Yeah.
Not liable. Have fun. Sorry, MEC. Okay, you switch printers and this map can be used outdoors.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's been a very successful map, you know, in terms of physical maps. So I'm happy with it. And then I made a few more in different parks. Around BC, and I've also made a map for the Algonquin Provincial Park in Ontario. It's Canada's oldest provincial park. But clearly found out, this is early days too, probably 2011, finding out that if you're going to stick your nose where there are a lot of players, you have to play a bit of hardball. There's many maps made in that area. It's hard to knock incumbents off, put it that way. Same with Banff. I made a map for Banff, and that's even worse.
There's furious competition in the Banff trail map arena?
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, wow. That's novel. I always tell people, like, cartography's wide open. Practitioners are dead. Go for it.
Might want to rephrase that.
Yeah, not for British Columbia wilderness parks.
I think that's the case. Well, most of them haven't been mapped at all. I know in that case it's fine, but when you have larger areas and very popular tourist attractions, there's a lot of people trying to get in on the game, so It's you have to convince the client that your map is better, and it has to be quite a bit better for them to, you know, it has to be extinguishingly better than the competition for them to move ahead and take it.
And are your sales mostly wholesale, like you ship a crate to MEC, or retail?
I've got both, Evan. Mostly it was wholesale because that's something that I could just do on the side and not really have to worry about. You know, you take a few orders a month from different clients and move it on, and then you forget about it. Didn't have this constant drip of stuff coming in and grabbing your attention. It was mostly wholesale to start, and then now I'm going more, focusing more on the retail side after putting out the Salish Sea map. You know, I've upgraded the changed websites, improved that, and now I have an actual setup here. I have a printer. I have a large format Epson, so I print on demand. Eventually, getting rid of the trail maps, folded products that I wholesale and retail, probably just go straight to reference type wall art, those types of products.
And so once this last run of folded trail maps is gone, you're not reprinting anymore?
No, I probably won't keep up with that. Unless I can figure out how to print on plastic as well. I think you can, but you know, then there's the folding process, which not really interested in doing that. I'd rather focus on doing larger format reference type / thematic art maps.
Stick on the wall, admire it. Not fighting over like, how do I fold this? And oh no, the ink ran and someone's going to die.
Yeah, someone's going to die because I made a map. Not a massive incentive for me. But, you know, it's just having inventory. I got boxes of maps all over my basement here, and it's like, okay, time to move that stock out and do not rinse and repeat.
That's a perfect segue. Would you mind giving me an end-to-end on making the essential geography of the Salish Sea?
This one, I think I started back in 6 years ago, just with the idea of making, I'll back up even more. So part of my thought process back then was, I want to make a reference map of British Columbia, because I was getting fed up looking online and trying to find a good reference map of my province here. And that wasn't forthcoming. So I said, okay, I'll just make one. And so I started looking around the web. And then I also at the time, just before that, like 2012 or so, Dave Imus from Imus Geographics had produced his Central Geography of the United States. Massively popular map. And I just reached out to Dave. And this is similar to what Alex did as well when he was doing his map. He reached out to Dave as well. And you know, just had conversations with him. And I did that independently. And we both were on email. He said, oh, yeah, actually, you should talk to Dave Ives. He says, oh, yeah, I have talked to him. So we're running down the same path. So after chatting with Dave for on and off for a couple of years, I decided that I think I'm going to kind of mimic how he approaches it with this essential geography notion. And kind of the less is more, and put on the map what you actually essentially need to tell the story and describe the landscape. And then the essential geography of British Columbia became the essential geography of the Salish Sea after I'd actually learned about the Salish Sea. I had no idea this bioregion existed up until about 4 years ago. And it just gelled a bit more and became, you know, the area of interest. And then over time just started researching data sets, other people who had looked into this, and it turned out that it's a very unmapped section of the world in terms of transboundary and reference style mapping. There is none. So I just took it upon myself to, okay, I'm going to make this a project, and then started in on that, you know, with the classic using digital elevation model data, starting to piece together the data sets, the transboundary data sets. It started to come together slowly. Me back and forth with Dave Imus asking questions. Ended up talking with Tom Patterson as well about elevation modeling, shaded relief, which of course he's the world expert on that. And Tom has Bernard Jenny in his back pocket, who is the bleeding edge of elevation manipulation. And at the time, this is a couple of years ago almost, Tom had introduced me to what was not yet called Edward, which was the machine learning neural network shaded relief tool that Bernie had developed down in I think he's, where is he at school? Can't remember, top of my head, in Australia. And so Tom says, "Hey, why don't I generate this one for you, see what it looks like?" And so Tom goes ahead, generates it. I slap it into 50-50 ratio with an analytical elevation model, and bang, out comes something that was exactly what I was looking for. And that was the basis. And I went from there with developing probably about 100 layers of data and merging it all inside of Illustrator to create the final product. Photoshop, Illustrator, two tools that were essential to making this, and also including First Nations Indigenous language place names that I thought would be an interesting foray, so that people would understand better what the landscape was about, and that it, you know, these were the original stewards of the land, and I thought it was important to you know, denominate some place names. Longer story would be that trying to reach out, or actually reaching out to Indigenous groups and understanding better what place names meant and how to incorporate them respectfully, was an insanely long process. And what I decided to do was go to public domain sources where place names were highly in the public domain, and then go from there and use those in the map. And sometimes I would have, as you know, probably two or three place names in different indigenous tongues. So that was interesting as well. What, you know, what's the primary language of the area? And trying to decide what to put there first. You can imagine Mount Baker has several names allocated to it. Now on the map, I think I put two or three on there, just to give you an idea that this many indigenous groups have this mountain as an important place name. A hair puller was bathymetry. Five or so data sets, various formats, various scales, had to be merged and rendered, and then merged again with the overall. What do you? Well, just back up. Had to be rendered, colorized, and then merged back in Photoshop with the digital elevation model for the Salish Sea bioregion. So that worked out well, but it was just a really a difficult and frustrating experience for me. I haven't worked with bathymetry very much, and realizing now that bathymetry is such a piecemeal data set, I would really consider not doing that again. But I mean, it really improves the map. So maybe I'm just talking out the side of my mouth here, but it was a very, very arduous part of the map.
You said it had 100 layers. Did you have something that went on first that everything had to conform around?
Yes, landscape first. If you have rivers that match an elevation model, you really get a 3D effect from that. If you don't, it ruins it. So I spent quite a bit of time with different scale data on the hydrographic side, trying to make that fit properly into the elevation model. You don't want to go the other way because it's too difficult. So yes, matching first was hydrography. Then I brought in transportation. And then I brought in infrastructure, other infrastructure items, places, dots, et cetera, et cetera. You know, really, one of the, of course, we have to figure out what's the hierarchy in terms of presentation. So, you know, park boundaries, certain park boundaries would be high. Some other boundaries, administrative or land boundaries, tend to be low and into the background. Forest cut blocks, these kinds of things, if they're relevant to state parks or provincial parks, have to be fit into the hierarchy. So that's a matter of, you know, playing around with the coloration, the symbolization, and then where it lies in terms of visibility. So that was done quite a bit. But I think the backbone of this thing is hydrography and transportation to conform with the bioregion, you know, as derived for the area of interest.
You conformed hydro data to the DEM. It's not exactly fitting in the valley. I'm getting my pen tool out and I'm making it fit.
Yeah, because also there's the level of detail that you get in any, you know, river data set, depending on what scale you download. You know, sometimes they're just missing certain streams and this and that. But you want it at the scale you're working at. You might have to go between, you know, a million scale or a 500,000 scale, you're trying to conflate these two, and it's a bit of a drag, but sometimes it's for the best effect. So I find myself doing that as well, you know, depending if I'm in the States or thankfully I was only in Washington State, and thankfully I was only in British Columbia, so I only really had two different data sources per se to tackle. If I had to, you know, bring in another province and another state, if I had a larger map area, I would be talking 200 layers of data trying to piece it all together. So, you know, when I say 100, it means that I might have 60 different layers from Washington, because I don't have the same data represented in BC as well, right? They have different data sets. Let's say just for the state, we don't have state data, we have provincial data, so it's formatted differently, it looks different, has slightly different meaning to it. So you're just wrestling with that and trying to make them normalized.
Alex said he hand drew every piece of hydro in the Saskatchewan map because of that problem. There's no such thing, apparently, as a cartographically friendly hydrographic data set.
No. You know, the same with Dave Imus, he's and Tom. Like, every time that I've talked to Tom or Dave about when they're making a map, it's like literally they have to start from scratch because it just doesn't work as is out of the box. And you can see that because oftentimes, you know, the National what is it called? The National Hydrography Dataset in Washington or in the States? NHD, I think it's called. Okay, so that one is incredibly detailed, up to seven different layers of detail, all the way down to very small streams. I think seven layers. I think that's what I was working with. And so you have to use. I was using a GIS to parse that and try to extract what I needed. But you know, it quickly devolves into just a gong show. And then you get, you know, what Alex does. You say, okay, well, it's not working. Either I spend 10, 20 hours doing this way, or I do 20 hours and get actually what I want at the end. So. Well, kudos to him for doing that, because that would have drove me over the bend.
Yeah, as a cartographer, you're choosing your either to start with a tangle and throw out, or start blank and start drawing.
Yep.
Thanks to GIS tools, you have the option of starting with the tangle, but you eventually hit that point where you're like, man, I spent 20 hours filtering, and I could have spent 10 hours drawing or tracing.
That's exactly what happens, and everyone's frustrated with the same thing. It just goes over and over again. Just pick your scale and hope that it works out best with the majority of the data sets that you find. And after that, yeah, I was parsing through data and just removing, like you say, start with a tangle and remove to what's essential, what you think is essential. Or, you know, sometimes you have to remove things if you're trying to label something, and the label is more important than the dot. So you're constantly wrestling with that. And I think anyone who's making these types of maps with this level of detail is constantly wrestling with annotation. That's the elephant in the room at all times for me.
Is your cascade, say, you're fighting with NHD? Like, okay, I'm starting in QGIS, I'm filtering, kicking out in SVG, editing in Illustrator?
I would write out to, I think it's, from GIS, I can do it straight to the dot AI format. I don't use any map publisher. I don't use any of that. I just export it with the common boundary from GIS to Illustrator, and you know, I edit mostly in GIS, and I tweak within Illustrator. But sometimes that tweaking turns into more editing than I did in GIS unknowingly when I started, ending up in AI and in Illustrator, going, wow, that really didn't work, and it was worse than when I started. So on several occasions, I've had to do it one or two times to try and get what I wanted. And sometimes I've just been completely frustrated with GIS, sometimes completely frustrated with Illustrator, which I think is not unique.
I am a map publisher guy because I'm too sloppy on the GIS end. I would have to go back to QGIS 50 times, like, oh, I forgot this. Oh, I got to add this. And just having a more two-way tool, like, oh, I can, you know, don't have to have an extra step of loading up a shapefile, exporting as AI, opening. And so that's been a good investment.
Yeah, have you been using it a long time?
Yeah, I started with Map Publisher. I used Map Publisher before I ever used QGIS or any GIS, because I started at a magazine as a graphics editor. And they were like, yeah, sure, buy $2,000 software, all yours. That might have taught me some sloppy habits, but it definitely makes it so much faster. It seems to be an even split for reference cartographers. McPhee is just QGIS to Inkscape, nothing else.
Yeah.
Tavares is Map Publisher, QGIS. That's what I like about cartography. It's all totally idiosyncratic between cartographers.
Yeah, I mean, we use Esri products in our consulting business. So, you know, I have that available to me. That's pretty much the only reason I would use that. Just to have it available. It's part of the business expense that we have with our clients. So, and all our clients in the business, our business, use an Esri. They don't use anything other than that for enterprise type architectures. So we're kind of, I think a lot of people use QGIS on the side because they don't want to pay for these, you know, the extensions that are required sometimes to do something simple, like in spatial analyst, you know, working with rasters, for instance. You know, you got to fork out another $1,200 just for the extension after already paying whatever $1,500 for the software itself, right? So you're at $3,000 to be able to edit a map. It's like, okay, no, I don't think I'll do that. I'll just use QGIS and go from there. That's a no-brainer. But lots of people get the basic Esri configuration, and then they use QGIS on the side to do all the specialized tool work. But on the enterprise side, everyone is, 98% of our clients are Esri.
You've mentioned earlier that the relief on this essential geography map was a mashup of proto-Edouard machine learning imitating Emmanuel shaded relief and an analytical relief. So did you superimpose both of them and then mask out certain parts depending on what region?
It's much simpler than you think. It's essentially putting the two in a multiply layers in Photoshop and just moving the transparency opacity button left or right and seeing which looked better. You know, and then I can't remember what I settled on, but it's probably pretty close to 40 on the Swiss style and a 60, something like a 40 or 60 from Swiss to analytical. I'd say it's in that ballpark. The Swiss style, its forte at the scale that I was working at, which is about 700,000. What I wanted was to pull out the large features, the prominent landscape features, and you know, obviously Swiss style relief work does that very well. I didn't mask out certain areas. I might have masked out an area in the Metro Vancouver area, because, you know, getting a mix of the detail and some of the flat spots with the analytical tended to be a little wonky. I vaguely remember doing that in the metropolitan area of Vancouver, just because it's slightly flat with a few hills in it. So I increased the level of detail from the analytical. That's probably all I did, you know, in terms of tweaking that. I think the result came out really well, because you can really see a lot of the landscape clearly, and you know, some of the big faults and some of the mountain ranges, they just pop out really well. And of course, the volcanoes pop out really nicely, because we have those in our backyard.
As a very step zero, did you have to merge different resolutions or scales of the radar altimetry or LiDAR data?
I used the Space Shuttle, SRTM, one of the later generations of that. And then I assume, you know, that's a good question. Now, I assume Tom Patterson used the same. I think I even provided him. I'm sorry I'm being so vague on this, but it was a bit of a blur. While I'm doing consulting work, and then I jump in and do 2 hours of mapping in the evening. So it was all fits and starts with this stuff. So I think Tom used the SRTM as well, and just put that through the Beta Edouard app, and that's what we came up with. But I'm pretty sure the whole thing is based on SRTM 30 meter data.
And since you were doing it so piecemeal, what was the end-to-end from first blocking it out to holding a test print?
I pushed this out in October of 2022, so I'd say about 18 months.
Was there a part that was longer than others, like, oh man, I spent months on hydro, or picking these indigenous names?
Annotation, Evan. That took forever.
Like the labeling, you mean?
Just the labeling, yeah. That took, I'd say, about at least 30% of the time, just moving things around. And you know, you just, as you're tweaking, you say, okay, well, this is not as important as I thought. That moves off. This thing gets replaced with that. Or I find new data that I didn't know about before. Add that in. Things shuffle about. That was in the later stages, though. That was probably in the last 6 months of working on this. It really started to... it came together quite quickly once I understood that, okay, I had a timeline. You know what? Sometimes I just don't put a timeline on this thing, and I work on it, which is not a good idea. You know, in your podcast, make sure people set themselves a deadline and try to window, do a time frame around that. I didn't have that because I really didn't know where this was going. I said, "Oh, pie in the sky. Yeah, I'll get this thing and I'll print it, and you know, it'll sell, kind of thing. Build it and they will buy." Towards the end, the last 5 or 4 months, I really sat down and started working. I would bet that I did 50% of the work in 4 months actual time. But you know, elapsed time is still 18 months from start to finish. But I think I did most of it in about 4 months.
Because you had a big chunk of time, or were motivated?
Well, yeah, I did have some time because of COVID. A lot of my clients just shut their offices up, and so I had several months with, you know, probably going down about 50% time, and then I was like, oh, okay, this is perfect. So I took that time and started getting into this.
Here's my forced mapping sabbatical.
That's correct. Yeah. Well, you may as well use it, right? That worked out well. And it just happened to coincide, the release time just happened to coincide, not intentionally, with the Black Friday kind of zone on the calendar. And I ended up getting some coverage with local papers here, the Vancouver Sun, which is the large daily in Metro Vancouver. And then next thing I know, I'm like, I'm sitting on it, my buddy's place. He's got some land in the San Juan Islands here, and so I'm sitting on his bench on a Sunday, and I get a note from the reporter that had come by. We can talk about this later, but he just sends me a note. He goes, "Oh, your article's published," and I go, "Oh, interesting." And then I get home on Monday. His islands is off the grid pretty much, so it's very sporadic. And I get home on Monday, and I've got like hundreds of map requests sitting in my Shopify account here, and I said, "Oh my God, how am I going to do this?"
Did you get home and think, "Oh man, I gotta fill a truck with postal tube"?
Exactly. Yeah. So next thing you know, yeah, I've got 10 boxes of postal tube sitting in my living room, and it was how would you say, warehouse looking, the warehouse decor. It worked out really well. Just a big sales bump over the holiday season.
I noticed you sell multiple sizes of this. What size was it originally designed at?
28 by 47, I think. And I think that's the best size. I mean, for me, I find that the most pleasing size. You know, on the wall, it looks good. It's not too big. And it's not too small that, you know, only people under the age of 12 can read it. If you're standing at the wall and you're looking at this map, you can be, you know, a decent distance away and still see a lot of the form, a lot of the landscape. You move in, you know, you're the zooming. So there's just enough detail there that happens when you're away from the map, and then when you get in close, it resolves nicely. I'm probably going to reduce that just to a single size, have one size that fits all, and not have to, you know, change papers and stuff. I hadn't really thought about this at the onset. You know, one map I can rotate sideways and print on a roll this way, and it takes all the paper, because you're trying to reduce wastage, right? Photographic paper isn't that cheap. So you try to reduce wastage when you're making these things. These are things you learn on the fly as you go along, right?
Like everything else in cartography.
Yeah, like everything else, yeah.
During your insane fight with bathymetry, was the hard part merging all those data sets? Like, did you have to cram them all down into the lowest common denominator resolution? Or were you like, "Oh, I got better sonar tracks in this area, I'm going to keep those and kind of blur it into the lower resolution stuff"?
I did a bit of both, you know, Evan. In the end, it was where I saw better data and it made sense to keep it, I would, you know, blur some areas and accentuate some other areas. So obviously, where I had the best data, I kept that data set mostly intact where I could. And sometimes other data sets would be masked or brought through the better data set just for the purposes of maybe reducing the visual optically, some mound in the middle of nowhere that wasn't that important, but it was distracting. You know, I did it optically like that. So rhyme or reason, it was done visually. And some of the data sets were probably three times as much resolution as others. But one of the main things was just the massive size of these data sets, you know, 200 and, well, we'd say like 2 gig data sets that you're downloading and manipulating to try get into I mean, I did strive at the beginning for a common denominator in terms of resolution. Didn't always work out because of, you're obliterating some data where you needed it. So what I decided to do is I exported these five different layers, brought them into Photoshop, and then started manipulating them in Photoshop, either reducing using filters or accentuating using filters, and then using layers, masking, cutting through some to visualize others. I think in the end, you'd be hard pressed to figure out where the boundaries were, and that's one of the things that took quite a bit of time as well, just feathering, because I'm not a pro at Photoshop, so this is a lot of learning in terms of the learning curve on Photoshop again. But so I think in a nutshell that was done. It was a bit of both, taking from some, leaving others away, and hoping that it would work out in the end. But an iterative process, to say the least.
So it sounds like getting them into Photoshop and then going by eye. I'm going to sharpen this, blur this. I had this horrible discontinuity. I'm going to fix it manually.
Exactly right.
And was that another Edward run?
No, Edward. If you put bathymetry through Edward, it looks very weird. This was something that I had no idea would happen. Neither did Tom. Tom tried it out, and he says, "Oh, you might want to skip the Edward on the bathymetry. It looked really bizarre, very strange, elongated." And I think maybe it's just because the neural network, when he was building, the data sets that he was using, I think he only used less than 100 Swiss large scale data sets to nuance to feed the model. So there was no large bathymetric data sets that went into Edward, and maybe that's the reason that they look so strange. I mean, even when you look at visually, when you look at comparatively between bathymetry and terrain, I mean they look different. Obviously, right? Different ways of whether it be glaciation or just water erosion. It's a different process for the two systems, so they look rather different. And I'm guessing it's because Bernie Jenny didn't have any bathymetry within his model, so it didn't really know what to do with that. So zero on the Edward for the bathymetry.
That's interesting. You're right. It must not have been trained on it.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. Didn't really know what to do. Well, it knew what to do with it, but it just didn't work out in the way that they were trained.
18 months doing this. Do you have any other inkling to do an enormous 4-foot map of this kind of scope again?
Yeah, no, I actually enjoyed it. After speaking about it like this, it sounds like it was just pulling my hair out for 18 months, but no, that wasn't the case. I enjoyed it very much. I learned a lot, got in touch with a bunch of people that otherwise I would, not know as well as I do now. And I think the aspect of introducing people to landscapes that they kind of know about, but increasing their map literacy, their geographic literacy in the area, I find that to be very satisfying. And so now I'm looking at doing a map of what we have here on the West Coast. So you go north of Vancouver all the way up to Whistler. You might have heard of Whistler, where they ski. Up through there is called the Sea to Sky Highway, or the Sea to Sky Corridor, and it goes north up into the Pemberton area. So right now, that's what I'm working on right now. So it's a larger scale map. It's probably like, I'm going to, what am I looking at here? 1 to 75,000 maybe, or maybe 1 to 200,000. I haven't figured it out yet, but anyway, so I'm going to be doing a similar style map for a smaller area.
Oh, nice. Have you started the data harvest and
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I'm quite a ways into it right now.
are you targeting same size, 4 by 2 feet?
It's probably going to be similar. Yeah, I think similar. One thing I will do is I'm going to keep the framing aspect. People are having to make, people want to frame this Salish Sea map, and I go, geez, I'm sorry, I didn't make this thing like a standard size, so everyone's got to make a custom frame, and it's prohibitively expensive. I mean, any frame that size is expensive, but if you can keep it to regular in stock framing sizes, I think you'd have more maps on the walls. Yeah, so you really have to think about the end product, which is I didn't do that with the Salish Sea. I just did it. Okay, well, this is the good size. This is the good dimensions that I should use based on what the bioregion looks like. So I did that aspect ratio based on visual and optically pleasing size for me cartographically, not with the end game. So I'm thinking about that more this time.
Starting with the target of how is it going to look decor-wise?
Yeah, well, how are people going to use this, and is it going to be, you know, is it going to cut their wallet in half just to have the thing framed? I was getting feedback from some people, and they were, you know, it's cost about $300 just to frame this thing, right? I mean, we all know that framing's expensive, but ouch.
I'm looking forward to 2025, Sea to Sky Corridor by Jeff Clark.
2024, my friend.
2024, nice.
Sure.
You said you're starting with the deadline.
That's right. That's why I'm an accidental cartographer. I keep having accidents. So you've got some interesting work on your website. I mean, you've made it into National Geographic, which is no small feat here.
Yeah, that was lucky. I was intern 2015, and they were so miserably understaffed that they thought, oh, Evan's worked at a magazine. He knows how our layout software and version control works. And graphics editor would come over with a manila folder about 2 inches thick and flop it on my desk and say, this has been pending for 18 months. Can you finish it? I'm like, yes, yeah, sure. And so I'd go rooting around in our old ARC files and conform everything. What that taught me is that every time I put on my resume that I was detail-oriented, I was a stone-cold liar. For example, I made this map of Germany's energy mix for solar and wind. Since it had city names on it, it would go to the map editor, who is a guy who has a master atlas on his desk, the $200 authoritative Nat Geo atlas, and a little magnifying lens. And he'd compare my map to the master atlas and then march over to my desk with the map covered in red ink and say, hey, move Mannheim a millimeter to the right.
Ouch.
I'm like, sure. And then submit it again and say, move it left. And then sit in a meeting and we'd have these Talmudic dialogues about whether a text box should have 18 words or 13 words. This is why you pick up a Nat Geo map and they're beautiful, gorgeous, authoritative, and you can look at them 10 years hence and think still looks good.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Not for me. Honestly, like the reason I went to grad school for cartography is, oh, I wanted to work for Nat Geo. Then I was an intern there and stood on the summit and I'm like, okay, not for me. And then just became a freelancer and started selling maps to whoever would write me a check that week.
So did you meet Martin Gamache?
I did. He was my supervisor.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, I know Martin. Yeah.
Martin was so busy, I was like, please, just let me sit next to you while you do a relief. Because that was something really hard for me. Like, every single time I made a shaded relief, it was always some terrible ass backwards process that never was consistent and never worked right. And he showed me how to do it. I look at the notes. It's like 3,000 words in Evernote. Again, total idiosyncrasy. No one else does it this way, and I can't do it this way. It's like asking a painter, how do you do that brushstroke to the left?
Yeah, it's a fingerprint, right?
Yeah, it's a totally unique thing between cartographers. And all of my shaded reliefs that looked good to me were doing it wrong 10 times. Mm-hmm. And then even the final product was wrong. There's a map I made of the Bay Area, California, and I made that hillshade by asking Google Earth Engine to make an enormous one that was way too big, and then shrinking it and playing around with it in Photoshop. So it's not properly generalized, but it kind of works. Every time I look at my notes for how I made a hillshade, I'm like, well, did that wrong.
Oh, I'm looking at it now. Yeah, it's nice. It's very nice.
It all kind of hangs together is what you're after. Every time you look at a map you did, you're like, oh man, I messed that up. But nobody sees that. That's just, you know, you're nitpicking.
So what's the one thing that you learned from Martin?
Have someone else look at your work. You know, under Martin's tutelage, you print it out, you stick it on the wall, people hang brutal post-its on it saying, change this, fix that, I want to see 10 more colorways. I'd be hauling my bike out of the locker at 8 p.m. and biking home in D.C. and being frustrated. But then when I actually held the issue months later after I went back to Wisconsin, I thought that was totally worth it.
Yeah, for sure.
Like,
yeah.
You can't argue with results.
Yeah.
If you want to make good maps, you gotta put them in the grinder.
Yeah.
Sand off the edges.
Good advice, yeah. And I'm lucky I did that back and forth with Dave Imus and Tom Patterson as well. And they're acknowledged on the map, of course, and they played a good part in directing me, you know, just being the guardrails in terms of how essential geography works. And I mean, Dave Imus on the geography part, whereas Tom on the relief part, but two very, very important components, obviously, and they have to work well together.
Did you send it to them for specific critique? Did they send it back covered in red ink and PDF notes?
not quite that intense, but it was like it was very much like back and forth. And with Pat, with Patterson, I would we'd go back and forth, usually in email, with a JPEG hanging off at the email, and talking about how to reduce this, how to increase that, should this be there, what if we tried this, you know, just really, really loose conversation. With Dave, I was sending him with specific questions, and we'd go through the questions and talk very specifically about certain things and why we'd do this, why we'd not do that, why we'd leave that out, or how do you get this effect, and much more detail oriented. And that paid off too, because and Dave's the master of just, you know, putting something on a map and making it look good, and it just works. So it's like, hey, Dave, you want to send some of that woo up my way, please? You know, he was a super generous guy. Really nice.
That's great to hear. And it shows. I've never attempted a reference map of that scale, because like when you said 100 layers, something tensed in me.
Yeah, you started a little twitch going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't look like 100 layers. I'm talking about all the different layers. You know, if I say bathymetry, then I've got five different data sets like that. It's all been aggregated down to probably, I'm going to guess, about 40 layers, I think, of data in there. Obviously, not every piece of that data is in the legend, because it doesn't need to be. I'm going to just rough guess that it's probably in that zone.
All those labels to hang together, not overlap, not fight with each other color-wise, it is so hard.
Yeah, it is hard. I mean, that's why I was saying it easily took 30% of the time, and definitely, even, you know, like it was getting intensely mind-boggling as I got closer to the end of October. You know, it's like, when does this thing end, right? When do you finish a map? That's, you know, this is a question you can ask anybody. It's like, when is a map finished? Of course, the answer is never. But if that's the case, you know, I wouldn't have sold a single copy by now. So why would I want that? So I have to figure out, What is the difference between good enough and finished, right? That's the gray area that you have to mess around with, and I think that's the hardest time to say it's done.
Close it.
Now, you know, I confess too, though, having print on demand, I can make changes. I can have people send in like, hey, you forgot to put this thing on. This is a really important thing on this little island here, which of course I wouldn't have known because I don't live there. And maybe it's not in any literature, but all the locals know about it. So to me, yeah, that has to go on the map. If I can put it on the map, I'll put it on. And I got a lot of feedback from people and was able to obviously update the map, because then I can just print out a new version.
If I order the map today, is it like version 30 of tiny updates that have accumulated?
It might be eventually, yeah. I'm probably at version 4 at this point, but yeah, it'll eventually get higher.
And so people have started the nitpick. Do they do that after they get it, or do they see the preview image?
No, they do it after they get it. Some people have actually identified things before they ordered it. This did happen a couple of times. And then if they did that, they got a free map.
Bounty system. I love it.
Yeah, totally. It works. But thankfully, on these maps, people would be hard-pressed to find that error unless they were seriously going looking for it. Really. And one lady found an error that was related to an airport three-letter call code. It was, oh, it used to be called that, but it's called this now. And so the data set that I had the previous version of the name, and it had been updated, but how am I supposed to know that, right? is this data up to date? What do I have to check it against? Sometimes you don't even have the up-to-date information to verify what you're trying to update. So she was in the business, dropped me a line and said, this is now called this. Well, thank you very much. And then she got a free map.
Well, last question. I know you mentioned Imus, McPhee, Patterson, Bernhard Jenny. Are there any other cartographers that people should check out, living or dead?
What I look at often is the maps themselves, not really knowing who did it, but seeing the map. There's an old map of the Banff area, and these are maps that I found while I was doing research. So, you know, like a map from 1956 or 1970 when Canada actually had some Swiss cartographers in the federal government. And, you know, just looking at those styles, that's the influences that I get. Not so much on the person, because they are able to be chameleons. Many cartographers can do that, and I'm absolutely 100% envious of them being able to just switch styles as they go to please the client, for instance. And of course, Daniel Huffman, just being the person that he is within the cartographic community, is a fantastic asset. And I've met, just the people at NACIS. How can I have a conversation here without talking about NACIS? That it's always been an excellent resource. I've met most of the people that I talk to about maps. I've met them at NACIS. So, to not answer your question, that's the answer.
All right. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me, Jeff. I got a little window into how the magic happens.
Yeah, sometimes I get the window into my own magic, per se. It's kind of a black magic, but it's all good. It's enjoyable, and I hope people enjoy the maps that we make for people. I really do. Paper maps are dead. Long live paper maps, right?
That's why I tell everyone, just pick it up. There's nowhere to learn, but if you care, you can revive it. There's no one to stop you.
Yeah, no, that's really good. It's good insight.
Well, thanks so much, Jeff, and have a great rest of your day.
Okay, cheers, Evan.
See Jeff's work at clarkgeomatics.ca. That's clarkgeomatics.ca. For show notes and bonus content, visit veryexpensivemaps.com. This episode is brought to you by The Map Consultancy, supplier of professional, data-driven maps for your decks, reports, walls, and events. Visit themapconsultancy.com to see what good maps can do for you. I'm Evan Applegate, I'm a cartographer, and you should make your own maps.
No one wants to see dull, ugly maps. If you want to get through to your customers, you need the best cartography money can buy. The Map Consultancy will create maps with your data and your branding, PowerPoint decks, annual reports, conferences and events, your office walls. The Map Consultancy does it all. Visit themapconsultancy.com and get the best maps today.